Hi, I'm Katie Green.
Hi, I'm Dan Green, and welcome back to the Greening Out podcast. And today we're joined by Daryl Becker from voluntaryvisions.com. Daryl, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you both.
So Daryl, what we'd like to know is, for our listeners who may not be so familiar with your work, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. Besides being Daryl Becker, I happen to be someone who lives on the Big Island of Hawaii. So that technically makes me in the United States in a sort of strange type of way. And I also happen to be a licensed acupuncturist, which is partially why I moved here, to gain my license. And essentially I've been trained in the Trivium method and critical thinking. This is a skill set that I got familiar with about 5 years ago. I mostly self-trained in that, and then I began self-training in the systems of nonviolent communication, that essentially these communication arts that were essentially created by Marshall Rosenberg. And I've taken these two to put them together and essentially made some of my own communication tactics, which I call voluntary communication.
Yeah, sorry.
Excuse our dog.
That was such a great question. I also talk to animals, and yes, I enjoy that.
He just like jumped right in there, right at the right moment as well. That was fun.
Yeah, so Daryl, if someone's not familiar, because we like to make everything quite clear, so what if someone asked you, what is the Trivium, how would you summarize that?
I would summarize it to say it is a system of critical thinking that was developed some, I would guess, around 2,700 years ago in ancient Greece, that essentially was composed of the first three of the seven liberal arts. Essentially, in the nutshell, grammar, logic, and rhetoric are their classical names. And in more understandable terms, that would be knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, or practical applications of knowledge and understanding. In computer language, that would be input, processing, and output. And essentially, and also very quickly, grammar is finding and answering substantially the questions of who, what, where, and when. Logic is removing contradiction, or at least isolating contradiction, and answering the question of why. And then rhetoric, which is answering how. A full demonstration of the practicality of who, what, where, when, and why. So that's the Trivium in a nutshell. It's essentially a methodology for learning anything and a constant good lens to check oneself to see how are you doing in your studies of any subject that you happen to be involved in.
And Daryl, one of my personal favorite things that you touch upon in your work is that of nonviolent communication. I'm quite interested in that. Could you go into that a little bit with our listeners?
Sure. So nonviolent communication has a very interesting history, which I plan to be delving more deeply into, as right. I have recently received some criticism for not looking into the nefarious history of Marshall Rosenberg.
Oh, no.
Or his teacher, Carl Rogers, actually.
Okay.
And it's true that these individuals might or might not have some nefarious history, as does Aristotle, who is, I would say, majorly credited with aspects of the Trivium method. Mm-hmm. For that matter, Pythagoras as well. So, I do like to look into the who of these things, but I have spent the last couple of years looking deeply into the what. What are these tactics that are being taught? How are they being taught to some people? And how did I find value in it? So essentially, what Marshall Rosenberg did, as far as I can tell, in approximately around 1972, was to take the 19 points of empathy that his teacher Carl Rogers came up with, mm-hmm. and he simplified them into a very simplistic format that was built to create, I would say, a rapport or a type of connection between one person and another. He was thinking of it as a communication tactic. So essentially it was understanding the observations, these are tangible, mm-hmm. that one would see and then another person would be seeing, the feelings that are presently being felt by yourself and the other person, the motivating factors, the specific values, desires, and needs of each individual that are basically the cause or the genesis of emotional feelings, and then taking note of the strategies and the actual actions, including requests that people make of each other. And he puts that into a format where observations and strategies, actions, and requests are on the tangible side. And then on the intangible or abstract side, there are feelings, because you can't have like an actual instrument to measure feelings. And the values and desires, which are also abstractions, meaning that they do not include proper nouns. They are not including strategies. So as an example, for folks who, you know, have a computer there, you can be looking up the Center for Nonviolent Communication.org, CNVC.org. Mm-hmm. And you could look up the needs inventory list. You look that up and you'll see that on that list of values and desires, there are no strategies. There are things like connection and honesty and respect and physical safety, et cetera, et cetera. There's a list of all of the standard ideas of what motivates people, essentially, what people are after. The strategies to get those things, that's where you can get flexible. So that's half of NVC, is just the knowledge of the observations, the feelings, motivating factors, which Marshall Rosenberg called needs, and actions and strategies, which he called requests. And he looks at it through that lens of both the internal, what's going on in you, and external, what's going on in someone else. And that's half of NVC. The other part that he invented, or I should say discovered, was the 4 Ds of disconnected communication.
Uh-huh.
These are methods of making, making a very palpable disruption of connection between you and another person, or you and yourself. They are delivering essentially a demand to yourself, delivering an unrequested diagnosis, such as giving yourself a label or someone else a label.
Mm-hmm.
Using deserve-oriented language, entitlement speak. I bet you guys over there in the UK really think you deserve free healthcare, right?
Not us, man.
I figured so, but you understand, entitlement speak, ways of... So there's one thing to do that. He definitely stressed that, you know, these things. There's the other one, of course, is the denial of responsibility. I'm just following orders, so I had to march them into the showers.
So,
that's essentially... you know, abdicating all responsibility.
Yeah.
What I've done with these tactics is, first, I've isolated myself that I wanted to use the trivium as a primary constant lens checker. I consider both of these methods, the trivium and NVC, to be an intellectual lens. And what I'm looking to do is I'm checking the lens quality. So I'm constantly seeing how well am I using the trivium, how well am I using NVC, and how are other people using these tools as well. That's kind of important to see what's going on. So when I was learning these skills, just to explain myself, I did not go and get certified, certainly not in the trivium because I don't even know of a place where that is happening.
Well,
I did not get certified in nonviolent communication. Yeah. I studied with people who were studying on Google Plus, in a Google Plus Hangout. I specifically worked with people who, just like you guys out there at Greening Out Podcast, and hopefully all of your listeners out there, were convinced of the veracity or usefulness, utility of owning oneself and not wishing to initiate aggression on others, and wishing, of course, to extend that to all aspects of one's personal and professional life. And that's an aspect of what people call voluntarism. So I was essentially learning NVC with voluntarists. And in doing so, I got to see aspects of how other people learn NVC. I got to go to some workshops here on this island and other places as well. I got to see how other people learn these skills. And many people learn the skills as a communication tactic rather than how I personally decided to self-study it, which was as an internal application to check myself and attempt to take 100% responsibility, meaning the ability to respond, to my emotional terrain. And with the trivium method, 100% of responsibility for my intellectual terrain, meaning that I'm just going to try to stand strong and see what's motivating me. And then, for the icing on the cake, I use these skills to try to communicate with others, which is probably why I'm on this podcast right now with you.
Because
that's probably the application that you're thinking, right?
Yeah, we were really, it's really interesting we've sort of been studying your work over the last I would say few months, few weeks, and we've been sort of following your work. And it's interesting because nonviolent communication, it sounds like such an ordinary thing. You wouldn't think I'm communicating badly to this person. We're all trying to be good versions of ourselves, I would hope. But it's amazing how sometimes that can come off very harsh and people have a complete disconnect with each other. I see it a lot.
I see it all the time as well, but this is why I've been training with these tools, and I collect other tools as well if I can, but these are the primary ones because I haven't found a replacement for them that's as elegant and simple. So I did mention the four D's of disconnection, that of essentially, I'll try to put them in a proper order, delivering demands, delivering an unrequested diagnosis. Since I'm in medicine, if I suddenly started diagnosing you guys and telling everyone on this podcast about your personal health problems, well,
Please
you
do.
didn't even request it, but
Yeah,
you can
sure.
imagine what that's like. It's the same thing if I gave you an adjective, like, you Scottish anarchists. If I gave you that,
That's great.
you'd understand. That's
Sure.
not what you asked for.
Sure.
And so it's an unrequested diagnosis. The next one is, of course, denial of responsibility and deserve-oriented language. What I do is that I don't hear many other people do is I have a translation matrix for these. So when I hear a demand coming at me, or unfortunately, if it's happening and if I'm having a troubled times and I'm delivering a demand to myself, I can translate that as instead of I demand that this happen, it's more of I'm translating it as I desire this to happen. It's understanding what that means. And the same thing for an unrequested diagnosis. When someone is giving me a label as, say, calling me an anarchist, they're attempting to gain understanding and comprehension by putting me in a box. This is them trying to understand, probably. That's a possible motive for them to choose that strategy of giving me that diagnosis, for example, or any diagnosis. They're trying to understand me. The other ones, I would say, deserve-oriented language, entitlement speak. That's an aspect where people are usually seeking ease and efficiency. God, if I didn't have to pay for things, if food and shelter and healthcare was just a right, and it's going to be provided for me, well, you can understand that that, of course, is a desire for ease and efficiency. It would be so much easier if instead of having to work hard to make these podcasts, to make interviews with people like you guys, and to have to get my rhetoric nice and smooth and have my words sound pretty one in front of the other. You understand, if I didn't work like that, it would be so much easier if I had someone else speak for me, the ease and efficiency. And then finally, denial of responsibility, also seeking ease and efficiency. But as we can imagine, the motives that people would choose behind their strategies are numerous. So I was giving examples of motives. So I want to understand motives. I want to guess the motives. And sometimes I will communicate as that might be a bridge that I make between me and another person. I might ask them questions to try to understand what motivates them. And that's very important. So when I hear people having disharmonious communication, or when I read it, for example, because there's a lot of text
There's a
communication
lot
between
online,
people.
yeah, sure.
But
You
when I'm
my
reading it,
articles.
I'm taking it in and I'm seeing where is the disconnect, where is the problem, basically. And I use these tools that I've been describing for the past few minutes to do a kind of a reverse engineering to understand the architecture of disharmony is, for me, understanding the principles of the engineering going on behind that, so I can understand how do I engineer harmony, how do I create the architecture of a harmonious interaction.
It's like
This
how,
is,
yeah.
yeah.
Sorry, on you go.
Well, that's pretty much it, Katie. I was just trying to, in a nutshell, this is the beginning of our podcast together, so I'm just trying to lay out the groundwork. This is what I do, and certainly more can be investigated.
No, sure. I was talking about how you're talking about the. I was just going to comment on how you're talking about the architecture of sort of the disharmony, and almost I thought of like you take it apart bit by bit, like a computer or something, to then rebuild it. A lot better, essentially. That's kind of I don't know if that's what you were going for. That's kind of
That's
what I.
exactly it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I can isolate it in little parts. For example, on the intellectual side, that's where you have the trivium method. That's where many people just jump right to the study of informal logical fallacies. And they'll start naming the fallacies, hopefully in their head, but unfortunately sometimes to each other.
Sometimes,
And
yeah.
it's okay to, have naming fallacies to each other if both people have given explicit permission to and an interest in that subject matter. But the problem is when people don't have an explicit permission or an interest in that subject. So that's the intellectual side. On the emotional side, I do use those four D's as a quick analysis to see if any of those are going on. And I also try to quickly analyze, certainly myself all the time, what am I feeling? And then my audience, who is listening to me, or when they become the author and I'm the audience and I'm listening to their message, that's the rhetorical triangle. So yeah, it's very important. That's, if I was teaching the trivium to you guys, this is an actual discussion, not a whole lesson. I've done many podcasts that are like that, but nowadays I'm just talking about the subject matter. The rhetorical triangle is an aspect of learning the trivium. It's composed of the author, the message, and the audience. And one becomes very acutely aware of when one is the author, who the audience is. So you tailor the message to the audience. And you can see out there in the various worlds of Facebook and other places where people are typing at each other that there is sometimes that disharmony because they're not really clear on these things. I'm using these skill sets to try to understand, certainly, if I can stand strong myself. And then, who is it that is talking to me or requesting an audience of me? And that is pretty much the deal. I'm just like you guys, I'm paying attention to the world. I woke up to these subjects, I would say, of voluntarism less than 6 years ago. So,
Oh,
yeah, there's a lot of learning going on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we're always learning, actually. I don't think there'll ever be a time when we're not. But what makes me think of when you were talking there is because I've approached a lot of things in the wrong way. Like, for example, someone's maybe mentioned something sort of innocuous, and then I've started to go, well, it's the government and it's fractional reserve banking, and I've just hit them probably with, I believe, what you would call a, I think it's an
An
18-wheeler
18, an
wheeler
18-wheeler
of logic.
of
Yeah.
logic,
Yeah. But I haven't built an empathetic bridge, probably, as you would say. And I've been terrible for that. Like, I'll just jump on people, but I don't mean to do it. But it's just something kind of hits in me, and I think I maybe react a bit emotionally rather than sort of taking a minute to really kind of think what's going on inside me and stuff like that. And instead, I just start jumping and just hitting people with facts that they don't want to hear. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean because I was doing the same thing, and that's why I came up with those three specific metaphors. So to give them in order, the first one is the splinters in the mind. They are essentially they're like composed of cognitive dissonance where you can see evidence of an emotional reaction essentially, where there's that type of impetus where it could be an intellectual splinter in the mind where they are a person is actually using one of the informal logical fallacies or more of them together to create their methodology of decision making. That's an aspect of a mental splinter. Emotional splinters similar, like the whether passively emulated behavior that was demonstrated by one's parents or other adults throughout the formative years, or for example, actual traumatic events that patterned a specific form of behavior, especially an emotional reaction to certain situations. So just to be aware of what those are, so that, for example, you don't happen to touch upon that. I found this was very critical to know so that I could just not be poking at a person's splinter, which is what I began to do when I learned about the logical fallacies. I would start to directly poke at a person's splinter. See, here's the problem. Your problem is you just appeal to this authority. But let me show you precisely how this authority is completely flawed. You can imagine that is not good. That could lead to the problems, which is the second metaphor, to make a bridge of empathy. Everything I was describing in the first few minutes of our podcast together was describing the architecture of building a bridge, I utilized the traditional, the letters are OFNR, observations, feelings, needs, which are motivating factors, and requests, which are strategies and actions. I use that as a bridge building mechanism.
Yeah.
I've discovered another bridge building mechanism, which is just to simply quickly, quietly isolate, why is this person that I'm talking to drawing breath every day?
Sure.
What are they alive for? Why are they alive? What gives them purpose and meaning to their life? And I could speak to any of those things as well. These are mechanisms that essentially build rapport and make a bridge between you and them. And then after that, then when I have the bridge nice and solid, then I go to my 18-wheelers of logic, the third metaphor where I can actually build the case and say, here is fractional reserve banking, you know, this is the process, you know. And so have you ever heard of this before? No? Okay. Well, this is going to take a little time.
Yeah.
Wrap your mind around this, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's like it's interesting. I think one of the little notes, I make little notes all the time and I have one in front of me. One of the things I kind of took away from it was the bridge of empathy and the 18-wheeler of logic going across it was, even if that's the one thing that you take away from this kind of ideology, if you will, if that's the one thing, I mean, how great would that be for people just to follow that? It's not like so difficult, you know, to kind of understand that, to speak to somebody in such a way, observations, feelings, needs, you know, requests, just being a good person, if that's the one thing you take away from it, it could be incredibly useful.
It could be. Yeah. And there are people out there who will find value in using these tools.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who will suspect these tools as being manipulative, which, again, is very important to be aware of, because some people could easily use tools that are similar to what I just described to manipulate themselves and other people. And there is the trick, of course. We are using tools right now, these words, and we're using an intellectual lens one way or another, whether we're aware of it or not. I like to be aware, and I like to try to be aware of what other people's choice of tools are. In doing so, you can understand what's going on and keep in mind the purposes of communication. For example, to have those questions in mind of, what are the purposes of this specific communication that I'm attempting right now? Something, a good question to ask as you're about to type on Facebook, for example. What is the purpose? What are you going to try to get out of? And here's another question. How can this, whatever I'm about to type, whatever I'm about to say on the Greening Out podcast, help make life more wonderful for all concerned individuals? And if I don't have a clear answer to that question, that could be very important. Maybe I might want to stop and formulate that answer before I get on this podcast, you know?
Sure.
Just a thought.
No, it's a good thought. No, it's good. It's good to question.
And Darrow, something that just came up when you were talking, and you mentioned it earlier on as well, and it was about manipulation and things, and one of my hobbies is sort of... One of my hobbies is magic and mentalism. It's something I like to do, you know, ESP cards, predicting cards, that kind of thing. It's just a hobby of mine. So I actually understand a lot about NLP and stuff, but what is the specific things that people are claiming about sort of NVC and Marshall Rosenberg and that in terms of manipulation?
Well, I would say that there's not a lot of, I would say, well-educated claims that NVC is being used to manipulate people that I've seen so far. I've only seen more people suspicious of it because of potential nefarious connections to MK Ultra, CIA, etc., which could appear to be verified through Rosenberg's teacher, Carl Rogers, and that's okay. I mean, meaning like that's very important to find such connections like that and verify them or not. I would say that any tool can be used in a variety of ways, and if everything is kept nice and sweet and honest, then there's a great potential for harmony. And if there is a desire for creating a win-lose scenario, so that type of scarcity model of thinking, the scarcity perspective. So if someone else has to lose for me to win, that could always be a potential that people will teach or use these tools in a way to get things from other people to manipulate. It's always a possibility for such things to be used that way, for any tool to be changed and altered to give it an edge, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is sophism, for example, is an example of taking the trivium method, specifically the informal logical fallacies, mm-hmm. and fooling people. Right. And that's essentially, you know, I would say, especially if you're using it to fool yourself, it's just making a mind full of splinters.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just say, why do I use the metaphor splinters is because pretty much anyone who listens to this has probably had a splinter, unless you were very sheltered.
I would say and, so, yes.
Yeah, so if you've had a splinter, you know it's not a medically significant, devastating condition that no one has a cure for. It's more of something that we all have some small empathy for, actually,
yeah.
that because we've felt it ourselves, and no one would usually knowingly push or touch someone else's splinter.
Yeah.
Or even yank it out. You might offer to help someone remove a splinter, but you would never reach into that personal space. And I wanted to treat when people use informal logical fallacies as decision-making processes, I would like to treat that as if it is a splinter, not medically significant that it's going to destroy them, but it is enough that it certainly is getting in their way, and
yeah.
we care about them as a fellow human being. So that's why I chose that metaphor.
I think splinters is a great metaphor, actually, for it, because cognitive dissonance, it's so funny because it is so pervasive. It's just everywhere, because sometimes maybe, like, I know people that, for example, I work with and I interact with, they will say one thing about one issue, and then they'll say another thing about another issue, and then another thing, and then it shows that they're not thinking in any kind of clear philosophical framework, because if you actually put out all their ideas on different issues, they're completely opposed to each other, but they don't think about logical consistency. And I think that's been a real problem with people. I don't think there's enough clear thinking and logical consistency around these days.
I think we see evidence of it all over, and
yeah.
the older the person is, the more evidence of such damage is, which is why I would pretty much say, mm-hmm. from my observations, these methods, in a simplified form, exist within all children
yeah.
and pretty much all animals until they're damaged.
Yeah.
Mammals, I mean, pretty much. And some of the others, you know, certain types of other animals as well.
Maybe.
They essentially yeah. take in the grammar. They're taking in all the parts of their universe, and then they're understanding how things work, how they sort of work, and how they absolutely do not work, which is logic.
Yeah.
And then they put that into a practical application. Input, processing, output.
Yeah.
That's the trivium. And then, of course, they like to dish out what they personally would prefer to receive, which is a simplified version of NVC. And that's kind of why I've moved away from the term NVC, or nonviolent communication, and I've moved more towards voluntary communication.
Sure.
Because I was finding it gets rid of the violent word, and then...
Yeah, you don't really want to bring up violence, yeah, yeah.
Right, and it's also distancing myself from necessarily all the things that Marshall Rosenberg says. It's kind of like I can take value in the concept of voluntarism, which you can
yeah.
Google on Wikipedia if you happen to have not looked up voluntarism.
It's awesome.
But that does not mean...
Yeah.
It does not mean that I take all of my things coming from Murray Rothbard. That's not
yeah.
at all the way I get my... I haven't even actually read a Rothbard book in total. I've only read passages.
Oh, they're good.
I don't need to.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
But I would see that it behooves me to study certain subjects when I'm conversing with certain people.
Sure.
But, you know, that's basically it. I would say that children are born with that, but damage happens.
Yeah.
And that's where we're talking to people who are damaged. The sooner that we can just understand and accept that, the better. Like, you start to see how you yourself listening are damaged. You start to understand how everyone that you're close to is in one way or another, multiple ways, damaged.
Yeah.
The damage being very innocuous, very, very subtle sometimes, or unfortunately not so subtle.
Yeah, that it does happen, yeah.
So, yeah, I guess people are damaged over there in Scotland too, huh?
Oh, yeah, sure, everywhere. I mean, I think all over the world. I quite, you know, I agree with you when you talk about children. Children are questioning everything. We don't, Dan and I do not have children yet. I don't know, you know, whatever, but we don't have them here right now. But if you've ever met a child, they go, why? How? Why is that that way? Why is the sun... Yeah, why is the sun warm? That they question everything.
And do you know what that's like? It's like Socrates, because Socrates was kind of like a child when you read Plato's dialogues, but he was like, why? He was always asking why and why. And that's kind of the test, if you've got any philosophical idea. If you can stand up to all the whys, then you know you've got a good idea. And but that's what's kind of funny. Like,
Yeah,
about society, like, they do have that why, but it seems as soon as kids get to public school, then the why and stuff is beaten out of them. And I find kind of public education to be, I think it's the wrong tone. You know, I don't know if you would agree, Daryl, but I think it's the complete wrong tone for children. I think they get the why and they get a lot of the time, the intrigue beaten out of them in public school.
Yeah, I think it's not only the wrong tone, but it's the wrong term. It's not actually... public education, it's public indoctrination.
Well, we agree.
Specifically. Oh, sure.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure you guys have heard me on the School Sucks podcast specifically, but, you know, certainly Brett Vinat takes great pains and many hundreds of hours to go over the architecture of that specific problem and to try then, at this point in his career, he's more into the phase of creating a different architecture to create more options, essentially.
Right.
So there are issues with that. I mean, most people that I know of, when pressed with the questions, essentially they realize that in the end of it all, they utilize the public schooling for childcare because they need to go make money so that they could afford to have this child and end their life in the first place.
Sure.
And that's an understandable situation, meaning that suddenly, you know, to accept that, to face that very raw, brutal fact is sad. And for them to face such a thing, I can see the sadness on people's face when they realize that they are outsourcing this time with their child and even the I would say, the quality of that child's capacity to learn one thing after another to very dubious sources. For them to face that bitter pill is really, really problematic, and it's a very difficult thing to share. People, of course, are very, very quick to repel any criticism of their own parenting styles or how they take care of their pets. Those are two very personal subjects.
Yeah.
So luckily, I am a parent. I am very open to having a critique of my parenting style, though my daughter is 18 and an adult now. So,
So it's a bit easier.
Yeah, it's just a different scene. And I've been very far away from her for the past 6 years. So, with, you know, brief spans here and there. But for the most part, I do pay attention still to the whole idea of parenting. And I certainly wish that everything I knew in the last 6 years I had replicated and put into play back when she was growing up. I did take from other sources. I certainly was taking from the work of Gene Liedloft, who created the Continuum concept, the book, and the internet community. Essentially, it's an excellent methodology of thinking, wherein this one researcher, Gene Liedloft, looked anthropologically at many cultures and how they took care of their own children. And the ones who were living close to nature were doing some very useful things in allowing their children a high degree of access and autonomy and choice and volition so that they would learn faster and learn more. And then there are cultures in her native England and America, where she traveled to, where there was that extreme restrictive nature going on. And certainly the term helicopter parent, which is... I guess an American term. It's pretty popular. It's that aspect of parents hovering over a children's life in many aspects, preventing them from hurting themselves or experiencing many things.
Could be a Johnson.
Yeah. So these are aspects of it. By the way, I have studied your podcast to some degree. I really enjoyed your discussion with Bill Bupert.
Yeah,
that was great. We really enjoyed that as well. Thank you.
Yeah, I look forward to talking with him someday in the future. And I've found it that type of hopefulness, because there you can see people who are finding the strength in themselves to analyze the problems, the various architecture and engineering principles that create the problems, and then to reverse engineer that to create solutions.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because, I mean, let me tell you, Daryl, we are up against it in this country. In a big way, especially just now. We're not going to get into it, but we've got a Scottish independence referendum coming up, and it's basically condemning us to socialism, but we'll calm down on that, because you'll get me going for hours, and you'll never get to do it. Now, what I was going to say, though, is it seems like from reading your work, if we can get serious again here, that you talk a lot about...
Did I lose you?
Can you hear us, Daryl?
I hear you now, yes.
Oh, yeah, we're good. Yeah, so what I kind of got a lot from your work was when you were talking... Well, I've heard you kind of talk and mention about being conscious in situations. And what it made me think of, I've been like quite a student of ancient religion and things like that. And it seems that this idea of being conscious goes way back to like ancient Taoism, and it goes back to like ancient Buddhism and things like that, and you could even argue Hinduism, this being conscious of like what's going on. And then it seems like in recent times, in the 21st century, it's been psychiatrists and psychologists or whatever that have talked about the benefits of this, and also New Age people. But it seems that it's quite a pervasive thing of, instead of just reacting to something, actually being conscious of what you're feeling and what's going on inside you at that moment when someone, for example, interacts with you.
Precisely. The major emphasis that I put on most of my work now has been an internal application, silently going, using these tools essentially as kung fu of the mind. That's another thing I do for my own upliftment. I'm a beginner in Bajitron Kung Fu. I teach beginners in Kung Fu. And so it's a physical aspect. It's a workout. It's mostly things that increase flexibility, strength, durability, endurance, and some degree of relaxation, because in many fighting arts, unfortunately, there's a lot of tension that's built up in unnecessary muscles like the face, which you never really use in that capacity. And so in the same way, these skills are kung fu for the mind, as when you stand strong, when you're not so easily tippable, you can't be tipped over so easily because your stance is really, really strong. These skills are an enhancement of one's own internal stance. And the purpose of that is not so that you can push other people over, but for the purpose of you can occasionally offer them a hand up. Because as we'll see, many people are very disharmonious. And instead of trying to push things away and down, like, I'm not trying to push emotions away, I'm taking note of emotions every single time when I can, when I need to, especially. And I'm trying to connect that emotion to the motivating factors that create the emotion, because they do not happen magically. Emotions apparently seem to correlate with actual desires and values that we formed either a long time ago or relatively recently. It's the knowledge of that, and then using the practical applications of that knowledge is what I'm generally trying to promote.
Well, that's fantastic. And you can obviously, as Dan said earlier, find out more about Daryl's work at voluntaryvisions.com.
Yeah, thanks for throwing that in there.
No, I was just as he was talking about it.
Yeah, that's it's good to research the who, what, where, and when, why, and how of Daryl Becker. I have to say, though, I mean, this is my one chance. I'm connecting over there to Scotland. I've never been there. Always wanted to. Can you tell me a brief bit about what this referendum is going on? And is that allowed?
Oh, absolutely, man. This is my domain. This is what I'm talking about. Well, the problem is it's been dressed up as an independence referendum. But it's not independence in any way, because they want to retain the power structure. So what basically the Scottish National Party are behind this referendum, and they're basically a National Socialist Party. I'm not that I'm making connections, but there you go. So anyway, under the terms, they want to make it so that Scotland is still a member of the EU, so world government. They also want to keep Scotland retaining the pound as a currency. Now, the pound is obviously tied to the Bank of England, which is fractional reserve banking, which creates debt for our children and grandchildren and so far down. And then it doesn't bother me so much, but they want to retain the monarchy, and I just resent paying my tax. I resent paying taxes anyway, but I resent it even more for the monarchy. But it's a bit deeper than this, and the problem is, if we were to attain an independent Scotland and make it kind of free market, so say, well, obviously I've just come out as an anarcho-capitalist, not that that surprises anyone, but even if we had like very small government and sort of laissez-faire capitalism in Scotland, that would be great. But that's not on offer. What's on offer is they want to write a Scottish constitution. Now, constitutions, in my view, are completely useless. I wrote an article about how a Scottish constitution will not make us free, and I used Lysander Spooner, the 18th century individualist anarchist philosopher. I used his arguments to show that we would all need to sign a constitution, and constitutions are basically meaningless. But what they want to do is they want to defend massive welfare payments. They want to keep the National Health Service and enshrine it into a constitution. So basically, if we were voting for an independent Scotland, what we would get is an extreme socialist state, because they want to, not only there's this bill gone through to have a government representative for every child. Make one of that what you will, they also want welfare payments to go up. They dress this up as, they call it social justice. Bizarrely, they want to reduce corporation tax, which kind of makes you think socialism is, are we moving towards fascism, if you know what I mean? And they want to get kids in school earlier, so as you said before, indoctrination, they want to get them indoctrinated much earlier. And they want to keep the National Health Service and put more money into it. So for us, it's kind of a socialist nightmare. Sorry to hit you with so much, Daryl.
No, that's what I was looking for, because essentially everywhere I go or everywhere I'm talking to people, there are the obstacles. The obstacles of centralization, the obstacles of tyranny, and the many, many applications that create tyrannical situations that remove choice from the many and deliver that choice then to the few, that essentially are putting chains on many, many ankles. And eventually, if you follow those chains, they lead to the neck of the ruling class. And, as you can imagine, horizontal enforcement, you got people essentially on the pretty low down part of the totem pole enforcing these situations that you're describing and other tyrannical situations upon similar people who have just as little as they do. So there's a lot of horizontal enforcement going on. There's a lot of centralization that has been attempted over these last millennia, and certainly in the last century, there's been a lot going on. Each obstacle presents an opportunity for any person who's innovative and creative to create a business, a good or service, to remove the negative aspects of that obstacle. And I'm sure you guys have heard of Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies.
Oh yeah, we
Yeah, for
take on
sure.
our website. Just
So,
a hint to anyone who wants to
please do send some millibits to these guys. Greening Out Podcast, send your millibits.
Shameless self-promotion.
Yeah, I'll
Send them a
promote you guys too.
Daryl
Yeah, by the way, if you want to, if you'd like to contribute to me, certainly my website, you'll see where you can do that. And if you'd like to pre-order the book that I'm writing on the communication subjects I'm covering, you can do that too.
Yeah,
But
no bother.
the reason I brought up cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin specifically, is because it is creative and it's an application that has an amazing architecture. It's innovative because it's the opposite of centralization. It's decentralized. It is, by virtue of being stored on hundreds of thousands of servers and computers and hard drives, etc., it is not in one place. It's a constantly growing number of places that all link up periodically to understand each other, computer language-wise, and have unity and agreement of what is the blockchain, basically. That's one blockchain for Bitcoin and another 300 blockchains for all the other cryptocurrencies and growing. So that's the aspect. That's one aspect. The other aspect is it's open source. So any geek can read the source code and pretty much try to see how secure this system is. And there's the people who are trying to crack it. They're called crackers. And if they can, they will try to counterfeit a Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies that are valuable. And so far, as has been evidenced, this has not been possible. So that is its level of security and its decentralization. And it's open source, and then it's peer-to-peer. So if I sent it to you guys, my millibit goes to, you know, say Dan or Katie, then that is just peer-to-peer. There's not going through a third party who's taking a little snippet of that.
Sure.
Unless I choose to go through a third party. But at this point, it's peer-to-peer. Those are some very important applications of this. And so this is one way where, you know, I bring up, like, what is this problem over there in Scotland? So you have this centralization problem. You've got, you know, obviously on that island, sounds like some interesting collection of millennia of tyranny going on.
Turning violent.
right. And same thing on this island. No different.
Yeah.
And, you know, the difference is, of course, that the distance between us, the tropical nature, the, you know, colonialization
the
aspect.
Oh, you mean the tropical nature of Scotland, yes.
Yeah, it's so tropical there.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, but the similarities are numerous. There still are people. You desire to have respect of your individual choice rather than being obligated to fulfill someone else's choice. And you could actually, you know, have a difference of opinion with someone who would say clenching to their fear of a lack of security, and they'll give up some of their choice for the idea of security.
Yeah.
And you can understand the danger of that, you know.
Absolutely. So. And one of the things that we've seen here a lot, I know Dan will agree with me on this, is a lot of patriotism. We've seen a lot of flags around here now, a lot of Scottish flags.
Of the like that we never saw before.
Oh yeah, no, the actual level here, and the one thing that it's actually bothering me quite a bit, this is one of my splinters, if you will, is the whole independence thing is you're either on one side or you're on the other side. And unfortunately we've had places have been firebombed, you know, in streets. Remember that one that we read about, Dan?
Yeah, and then see, even after this is done, any political reforms that happen in any context are going to be...
You should have voted
that way. It's divide and rule, yeah. They're going to say, well, you didn't vote independence, or you did vote independence and this has happened, blah, blah, blah. And it's just...
They have divided the people of Scotland.
Yeah, it's basic divide and rule. Classic tactics.
Yep, that is classic.
Yep.
And that's why... When you isolate that as its logical fallacy, you know, the fallacy of division, essentially, it gives you a tool, basically. The tools are like handles that when you had a whole bunch of heavy boxes with no handles on them, they're kind of stuck in place. They're difficult to move around.
Yeah.
The logical fallacy tool is a tool that you can put on and say, instead of two choices, I would like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 choices. I'm going to look at a whole bunch of choices, and I'm not just stuck within that. And instead of the divisiveness of voting for, now we're all Scottish, or, oh, now we've joined the UK. You know, wonderful. And you dropped your Scottish accent.
yeah, sure. Why not?
That'll be the day.
Okay, yeah. From Canada.
I'm actually from Canada, so I have a weird kind of twinge to my voice. I don't know. I don't really know what mine is. I don't know. Whatever.
Either way, it's wonderful, and I love when people hold on to it. I tell you that. I mean,
oh,
over here.
You.
But I think, you know, by the way, this is a New York accent, in case you don't understand where
is
my
it?
Voice is coming from. Uh-huh.
Oh,
it's one of
you?
A variety of the ones. I grew up in upstate New York,
okay.
Where you get all those newscasters, that type of voice, you know?
Because we talked to Walter Block last night, and he sounds way more New York than you do, but
well, he's from
Brooklyn.
He's from Brooklyn, Walter
what
Block.
What we would know is New York.
Right, and so you're speaking of New York City specifically.
Like
my dad's from the Bronx.
Stereotypical.
And the Bronx is a different type of accent.
I could see that there.
As opposed to the state.
I could hear it there.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. Actually, I didn't know how to identify a Canadian accent until I started going out with Katie. Because honestly, I didn't know, I couldn't tell the difference between an American and a Canadian accent, but see now when someone says anything like a boot or something like that, then I can just, I know it 100%.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
I love that word.
That and Trailer Park Boys is like, a boat.
That helped, but Daryl, don't you think that, as libertarians, like, well, I don't know if you would call yourself that, but we would, right? So if we are libertarians and we are, say, respecting the non-aggression principle, okay, but then we speak violently to someone, like I say, like I talk great about, oh, the non-aggression principle, I don't initiate violence, I'm a peaceful guy, and then someone says something about the government and I go, oh, but don't you know the government are terrible and this and that, then don't you think without non-violent communication I'm letting myself down?
Yes.
By saying I adhere to the non-aggression principle and theory of physical aggression, but then I'm not agreeing with it in terms of verbal aggression.
I think that the philosophical and intellectual lenses that we're using, including the non-aggression principle, are tools. And again, it is up to the individual to check the condition of the tool that you're using and to measure the applications of the tool, the final product of how did you use it. So you can see the disharmony when you say it in a certain way to a certain person. And you could also imagine, you know, and I'm sure you've seen examples of it, where you brought it up in just the right way. You introduced it with the right context. Mm-hmm. And then you made a bridge. And then your cargo was adequately received on the other side. And learning began to proceed. And things happened. Such as the person who is afraid of spiders and essentially afraid of trying new foods and is mm-hmm. hearing that lobster is actually like a sea spider. And they're connecting these two things fallaciously and totally missing out on a delicious experience.
No
see?
More lobster. You'd
right,
be like,
right.
Oh, yeah, of
and,
course.
And so it's just an understanding of things like that. And so labels, which are, when you deliver them, they are a form of diagnosis. It's
sure.
something I always make sure to stress, because I have been a professor of Oriental medicine teaching acupuncturists, not just being an acupuncturist. Mm-hmm. And in that process, I always made sure to stress that make sure to only give a diagnosis at that point and deliver it to your client when you have a treatment plan, because they're not just paying you for the diagnosis. They're paying you for the treatment plan that's attached to the diagnosis.
Sure.
So if you give yourself a diagnosis and you have no treatment plan attached to it, and you give someone, or if you give someone else a diagnosis, like you know, essentially you libertarian, you know, there
how
is
dare
a point
you
for that. It does, you know, for quick ideas, you know, you want to identify some of the intellectual lenses that you utilize in your day to day. You've done it by giving yourself that diagnosis and telling me about it, and that helps me. Like
sure.
same thing of like, who are those people over there with their signs holding in front of that clinic? And I could be saying, oh, you know, like those are pro-life activists.
Yeah.
They're protesting the abortion clinic. And I gave them a diagnosis, pro-life activist, for the purpose of clarity, but not to try to say that's what they are in the rest of their entire life. Like they have no other interests. They have no other connections to other people. That's all they are.
Yeah.
So, you know, labeling is disabling is that old...
So don't
little rhyming thing. No, it's an idea. Just be careful when you're doing that to yourself and others. It's not to not do it, because again, we're trying to communicate. And you want to give me a quick idea of who you are, of use the word libertarian. I could say, yeah, and myself, by the way, if I'm gonna use a label for myself, I call myself an individual. I use that term.
Sure.
I am an individual.
Sure.
And I use technology. Intellectual technology, physical technology. I use technology.
Yeah.
And I do have serious applications and value in the non-aggression principle. I find almost no fault at all, technically speaking, in the dictionary definition of voluntarism. And for the most part, you know, that helps me see eye to eye with almost anyone. Anyone, you know. But that's anyone who good. Wants to have authoritarian applications, you know, that's them. You know, folks that I've known who've gone into the military. I'm not sure if you've ever been friends with someone who's gone in the military.
Not
personally, no. We come from Irish families, so they go, "Hey, don't go near the British military."
Yeah, you see, and like over there, that would be like, you know, a piece of wisdom, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like wisdom that was gained like centuries ago, you know. And where I am here, there was a lot of PR, a lot of public relations, a lot of Edward Bernays, as you've mentioned before, going on.
Oh, yes, I have. Oh, you've been listening to us.
Oh, yeah, I'm paying attention. So, and I recommend you guys out there re-listen to the Bill Bupert interview. But essentially, what I advocate is to do a constant reanalysis when you have time and when you have the emotional capacity, a reanalysis of where it is that you get the conclusions that you're getting and how do they serve you. So a lot of people are just sort of plodding through and they're not doing that reanalysis of where their perspectives are originating from and how practical is it for achieving both the purposes that they are seeking and the making life wonderful aspect, my other question.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, that's basically, I was, you know, kind of curious about that part. And here's my question for you guys. Since you've looked a little bit at my work covering nonviolent communication and the trivium, have you seen any applications or value in it, say, regarding the biggest conflicts in your personal or professional lives?
Oh, yeah, we have seen it. Well, do I go first?
I was just going to say that I've definitely tried to do it more when I'm communicating with people at work now. It sort of helped me almost to kind of use the term voluntarist a little bit more. And I'll say, have you ever heard of that? Do you know what that is? People say no. And I kind of go into a small, I just say, well, I think all things should be voluntary, all interactions between people, and I respect people's property and not to be coercive or violent towards them. And it's really helped me sort of, I would say, the bridge of empathy, that really helped me communicate with people, especially people at work who I am somewhat forced to communicate with.
Well, see, for me, I've studied philosophy for a long time, and then I've realized that from studying you go back to Plato and stuff like that, and the ancient Greek philosophers, and the Socratic method, and it's funny how I'd read all those things, say maybe 8-9 years ago, and then sort of not taking it through, because suddenly I jump on someone when they said something, but then I realized you need to go back to first principles, and your work kind of made me think that instead of this government's terrible and stuff, rather let's go back to first principles. For example, regarding government, let's say, do you think violence is wrong? And just asking the question in a calm way and throwing it out there, you know, and maybe in my mind it's like building the bridge of empathy, you know. Do you think violence is wrong? Do you think coercion is wrong? Yes. Do you think theft is wrong? And then we can get there in an easier way to, I'm not saying that I need to make everyone believe that government is bad, but I'm saying instead of just jumping on someone and go, let's abolish the government, it's easier just to start from first principles and go from there, you know?
That's excellent, yeah. This is an application of what's going on that I see around the world right now. There are people who are using these tools or anything that yields similar results, and they're finding better situations, basically. By having harmony inside of oneself, there's the beginning that I see, where you're actually able to stand strong. Then you can even consider to create harmony between you and others. And then, when you have that harmony, then you have communication possible. When you have communication, now the creativity, which was already latent in every single child and hopefully flowered fully as an adult, is there. The creativity creates innovation. Innovation, mm-hmm. such as decentralized cryptographic solutions. And the cryptographic part was the final part of Bitcoin I didn't mention, because when things are hidden cryptographically, it makes it amazing and secure. That's security. So instead of people trying to form these great big nations, even splitting apart with big things called Scotland, I would rather prefer that everyone start by splitting off into things called being an individual. And then from there, collecting together with like-minded people or people that they just really, really appreciate spending time with. And from there, you can actually create things, such as in North America, there are things called intentional communities. Actually, they're across the planet. I think there's even some over there in Scotland. You can look up the Fellowship for Intentional Communities. You could look up the worldwide systems of people who've collected together, and they are living in a variety of ways, some with forms of government, some with various forms of what we would call anarchy or respect of the individual, and many types in between. So this was an application that I see is people separating themselves from these artificial collectives called nations, at least in their mind, just to start with, to stop calling themselves an American, a Scot. Stop calling yourself that identity thing that is part of a group that is composed of people that you have never met and will never meet, because it's impossible, you know. And instead, just starting with yourself and then collecting together with people specifically of your choosing, then, you know, there's the decentralized nature of getting together like this. Here we are, voluntarists across the world, right here, right now, collecting together in a decentralized way. It's a distributed network, essentially. And that's how I learned nonviolent communication, was through a distributed network of people who were essentially video chatting from hundreds and, like with me, thousands of miles apart and adding value to each other's lives. It was a phenomenal experience, and I still participate to some small degree in that, but for the most part, I'm also now in the real three-dimensional world of making the Big Island of Hawaii work for me in the way I've just described.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of funny how we're talking about, like, you're talking about we're all individuals, and Walter Block, when we were talking to him, he said, like, I believe, you know, obviously he talked about Scottish secession, but he said, I don't just disbelieve that Scotland should secede, I believe that everyone should secede, like, even an individual person, you know, I should just secede on my own from, the, you know, like, you can choose to opt into the government or your local council or whatever it is in Hawaii,
Yeah, and for that matter, I mean, it's an application of people suddenly seeing the value of who they are as an individual. And over here, we've got special words for it because this is a place with its own language, Hawaiian, and its own other language called Hawaiian Pidgin, a combination of Hawaiian words, English words, Portuguese words, etc. And that's its own funky language. But not very many people speak actual traditional Hawaiian, but definitely, I mean, not many compared to the full total population on the island is what I mean. There's a lot of thousands of people who speak that, but there's, you know, a much bigger population here who does not. And but there's many people who do speak Hawaiian Pidgin, many, many people. And amongst those words is the word ohana. In both of the language, in traditional Hawaiian and Hawaiian Pidgin, ohana means family. So it's an aspect of understanding who is part of your ohana. And the people like myself who moved here to go through a college and join the professional medical guild that I joined, basically, to protect me, the guild of acupuncturists and oriental medical practitioners.
So the government can certify you.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I got my number. I'm number 1070 here on this island.
Nice.
Nice.
And so I mean, there's a purpose for that. And in that part, I joined an ohana. I joined the group of us fellow practitioners who actually know each other and, to various extents, care about each other and help each other and connect with each other, because we see the value in the power that happens beyond just being on our own. There always is the power of being on your own for the lone wolf, for the person who's really self-sufficient. And then, of course, there's most of the rest of us who find power in collecting together, which is why I was psyched that you guys reached out to me to make a podcast because I want to collect together with more people.
Yeah, as do we. And Daryl, this has been great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we've really enjoyed this, actually. Daryl, tell us about your website and what people can find on there.
If you go to my website, voluntaryvisions.com, you can see and listen to every single podcast that I've been on and read the essays that I've written. And you can see a little bit of the book that I'm working on, which I ask people to consider donating to or pre-buying, which you can do.
Please do.
And that essentially the book that I'm writing is The Language of Choice, which is essentially putting together these skill sets of the Trivium method of critical thinking and my own version of nonviolent communication and creating a way of essentially making more harmony in one's own life.
That's awesome, Daryl. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. And I really, really look forward to hearing more productions on your end too.
That would be fantastic. Okay, so for more libertarian podcast writings and news, you can go to greeningitpodcast.co.uk. For more Daryl Becker, you can go to voluntaryvisions.com.
And Daryl, thanks so much.
Thank you guys. Have a beautiful day.